Here we go.
Welcome to BP WrigleyCast, the Cubs podcast that panics first and asks questions later. With me tonight, Isaac Bennett, Ryan Davis, Joel Reese. I am your host, Carlos Portegura, and we have not all been on the podcast for quite some time. I've been away, and I have to admit that when I left, I came back, I listened to the two podcasts, and you always hope for there to be something that goes wrong, maybe not any technical issues, no robot voices, but you want to listen to those podcasts and go, it was all right. And I got to say, the last two that I listened to that I wasn't on, they were both fantastic. So well done, guys, and I'm happy to be back.
Happy to have you back.
Happy to have you, Daddy.
Daddy, we missed you.
Kids. Let's jump right into the Cubs limping into the second half. They're still on a 97 win pace, but they slow down considerably heading into the break. And let's talk a little bit about it. I think we're going to all be on the same page on this, but I'm curious to hear what you think. Joel, let's start with you. Are you panicking?
Awkward laughter. I am the most likely to panic of anyone, so I will accept that. I will wear that mantle proudly. I think that the thing is that you can look at, you know, Ryan did the great piece earlier this week about, you know, just all the reasons why we shouldn't worry. And Carlos, I remember your piece of a couple months ago about the inevitable regression that we were going to see by the pitchers. And I don't think that you anticipated to be this drastic, but, you know, nevertheless, I think we all knew that they weren't going to keep it up. But so I think the smart fan realizes that, you know, this is a marathon, not a sprint, and that there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic and, you know, just to see this as an unfortunate glitch. But what you're seeing in front of you, you can't help but be like, but oh my God, this is like bad. And there was, you know, there was just all, everything was going wrong. You know, Baez is throwing the ball away, or Contreras is throwing the ball away when Baez is running in, or Rondon's giving up homers, or Jake Arrieta is, you know, human. And I think that a lot of the things can be explained away, you know, just as, you know, regression or things just kind of going wrong is there, you know, because they're not always going to go right. And that's just the way it is in a 162-game season. But I do think that there are a couple things that are reason for pause. And I know we've talked about this before, but, you know, I guess number one on the list would just be Arrieta and Lester, too, looking just not great the last couple starts. And, you know, maybe this is just the up and down and the roller coaster of a season. But I think that the starting pitching over the last 30 days, the war-wise was 28th out of 30 in the league. And I know that, the season is not just 1 month, but the regression is pretty dramatic. And when you're thinking that your most consistent pitcher is Kyle Hendricks, and as I certainly was the last couple of weeks, I feel like something is amiss. And so that's the kind of thing that gives me pause and doesn't make me – that I can't just say, oh, whatever, I'm not worried about it. You know, are they going to make the playoffs? More than likely, but there's still some things that you're seeing that for me personally, make me a little nervous.
I'm more there with you this week than I was last week about being just a little bit nervous. And it's not so much that I think, you know, oh, is this team just not good enough to make the playoffs? It's more so that I'm more nervous now that the Pirates and the Cardinals are starting to sneak up a little bit in the standings, that the chase for the division is going to be a bit more interesting into the rest of the season than we might have thought when they were, you know, whatever, 11, 12 games up on everybody. But to reference the piece that I wrote that you just mentioned, I tried to go about dismantling all of the bad narratives of the last couple weeks. You know, the Cubs don't beat good teams and that's a bad thing, or, you know, they can't win one run games. And I went about that, you know, pretty easily. The one that I want to focus on right now, though, is the last six World Series winners. And this is something that I've actually seen people say flat out, I refuse to believe anyone who's won a World Series in the last few years had a stretch like the Cubs have had. The 2015 Royals, from August 30th to September 22nd last year. So running into the playoffs, we're 7-16. The 2014 Giants had a stretch of 5-18 that ran about parallel to where the Cubs are right now. The 2013 Red Sox had a 2-9 stretch. 2012 Giants had a 12-16 stretch. 2011 Cardinals had a 3-12 stretch, and the 2010 Giants had a 4-12 stretch. So I think as far as just what they've been doing specifically on the field, it sucks to watch because it's frustrating as a fan, but I don't see any reason why what we're looking at right now, we can say, well, they're whatever, 5-14 or 6-14 in their last 20, so clearly they're just not good enough. I don't see that as something that we could say.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to take the opposite side of this completely. The only team that I can remember in the regular season that was completely infallible was the 2001 Mariners. I was 14 years old that year. And I remember following that team, and they were a collection of just unbelievable hitters. It wasn't their pitching so much that was dynamic, but they just had so many guys that were well above average hitters. And they only had one stretch of games in the entire season where they lost more than two in a row. They lost four in a row, and it was in late September. They were 106-40. Think about that for a minute. And they lost four in a row to go to 106-44. Talk about irrelevant, right? They started up 18 games in the division at that point. So they get into the playoffs, and we well know that they lost in the playoffs in the ALCS. And I remember thinking back on that team and thinking, man, there's such an emptiness there, and they never encountered adversity until they faced a seven-game series. When I look at this Cubs team, I look at them in the micro, and I think, do I believe in this 25-man roster? Can I look at this Cubs team and say, I believe in each and every player here more than I believe in their counterpart on another team? Unequivocally, my answer is yes. So at the end of the day, what I want to see, and this references back to Ryan Davis's piece, and if you haven't read Ryan Davis's piece, you need to go read it right now, because it is unbelievably good, and it tells towards what baseball is better than probably any piece I've ever seen, which is that every winning team goes through adversity. I believe that to win the World Series, you have to go through a stretch of games where you face adversity, so you understand how to do it. I think that's especially true for a young team. So I'll not only say I'm not worried, I will say that I am excited about the fact that in July this team went through a terrible stretch of baseball where everything went wrong and all the pitching regressed just like we told you it would, and there's still seven games up in the Central Division. I'm literally happy about it.
It's interesting, something you said there made me think that there could be a silver lining to this stretch, and not just the facing adversity part of it, but at the beginning of the season, being picked as the favorites to win the World Series, you've got that huge spotlight on you, that huge bullseye on you, and that's kind of faded away. Now you get more of the people chirping in and saying, oh, what happened to all your bravado from the beginning of the season? Now, I wasn't of the bravado type of Cubs fan at that point, but there were a lot of people out there kind of puffing their chest out and saying some things they probably shouldn't have said. So that's something that could be a silver lining. The other thing is, it's one of those things that underscores how baseball, a season of baseball of 162 games, it's long, man, and it's hard for us as fans to kind of understand how many things are involved in playing 162 games. Last year there was a stretch, I think it was June or July, where they just could not score a run. You guys remember that, and it was just painful. You thought, gosh, this team is, they need something. They cannot score a run. And it was just a stretch, stretch of games where that stuff happens. So it's interesting that there might be, something good to come of this, or more than one thing that comes of this.
I'm looking at the
Sorry. Go ahead, Joel.
I'm looking at the 2005 White Sox game schedule results. And on August 1st, they were 15 up. And then on September 24th, they were a game and a half up. So they fell that far in, a month and a half. And then they, so this is kind of undercutting my own, what I was talking about earlier, but and backing up what Ryan was saying, that it's, you can't really draw that many inferences from the regular season, because that was a near historic collapse. And they got to the postseason and they damn near swept every round. I think they lost one game out of the three rounds that they played. So you know, yes, everything that you've said is true. But I do think that, you know, I don't know how much we want to go into this, but, you know, I do think that there are, like, I mean, is Jake Arrieta just going through a little trouble spot, or is he, you know, is there something going on with him? I mean, it seems that the consensus that I'm hearing is that he's maybe a little too much in his own head and is just kind of overthinking rather than, you know, just being the stud that he was the last couple of years. But, you know, whatever the cause, he's not, you know, the Iron Man that we anticipated.
I want to hear Isaac's thought on that in just a minute, because Isaac had an amazing interview on The Score this week where he talked a lot about Jake Arrieta. But I just wanted to throw real quick back to what Carlos was saying and what you guys have just said in general about the regular season and all the things that do and don't matter about it. You boil the 162-game season down to, for most teams, a best of three to start it, and if you're a wild card, a best of one. The only thing, and the point of the piece that I wrote is, the only thing that you can really count on as a measuring stick of whether you have a chance to win the World Series or not is whether you make the playoffs. And I, that sounds funny to say, but one of the big stats that I had was, of the 15 teams since 2000 that won 100 or more games in the regular season, only one won the World Series. Wow. You actually have better odds if you make the playoffs winning less than 90 of winning the World Series the last 16 years than you do of winning 100 or more. So that just gives you an example of, you know, you win 100 or you win 116 or you win 88 in a bad division, it really just doesn't matter.
That's a powerful stat, and I think that actually speaks somewhat to what I'm trying to say, which is it's actually better, in my opinion, to enter the playoffs having faced adversity and maybe actually having a race to get into the playoffs, because it keeps you at the height of your sort of sensation as having to compete every day, and the playoffs are about competing every day. And I just did not want to see this team come into the playoffs. I didn't want them to win 110 games like they were on pace for a while. I wanted them to win far less than that and have somewhat of a challenge to win that division. Now, you need to win it, but I think what you just said really hits on something, which is that the playoffs are not indicative of the regular season. They are their own animal, and I think the adversity is really good for this young team.
Yeah, well, it sounds like we're totally on the same. Joel, did you have something you wanted to add?
Well, I just was going to say that I think we're kind of on the same page for the most part, but I do think that fans, you know, you're asking fans to kind of go against what they're seeing. You know, they're seeing a team that was 35-6, was it? You know, and suddenly everything's falling apart. And so, you know, you can say, okay, well, take the long view. And the more thoughtful fan will say, yeah, you know what, you're right. But, you know, there are a lot of fans like, yes, but I'm still freaking out because I'm seeing a crappy team. And so I think that's probably the cognitive dissonance that's causing people to not be able to, you know, take the long view, because what they're seeing is not, you know, in front of them doesn't jibe with this kind of longer term, more esoteric, thoughtful philosophy. And so some people just can't go bigger like that. So I think that's kind of where the problem comes in.
That's very fair, and I hate losing as much as the next guy. I genuinely do, but again, I think you need to boil it down to the micro, and one thing that's very encouraging about this is that you've seen Anthony Rizzo and Chris Bryant both explode during this time and both cement themselves as MVP candidates, and when you have two MVP candidates in the middle of your lineup, you're very tough to beat in the long haul. And you've got a couple of guys that are 150 weighted run created plus type guys, around 400 on base or higher. You're very tough to beat in the long haul. And I think that, you know, if people settle down and think about really still how good how that starting pitching staff is, and this regression was coming, you just have to take solace in the fact that what they did in the first 3 months was not sustainable. And when you acknowledge it wasn't sustainable and some of these rough outings were coming, it makes it easier to sleep at night.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we want to go much more into this. I understand we're all kind of in agreement, but if it would be interesting to show those statistics of, you know, Jake Arrieta at the pace that he was before this rough patch, what his season-end stats would have been, and it just would have been, you know, video game-like. And the last thing I wanted to say about this was was about, you know, one of the good things, another good thing that maybe has come out of this is the fact that this happened, this stretch has happened now, before the trade deadline, which kind of magnifies, and you know, it gives you a more clear idea of where you need to patch this roster up in preparation for a playoff run. So, and I don't want to get into the who are they going to go after, who might they go after, but it's good to know, okay, when we hit adversity, these are the parts that typically, you know, need more attention. So, and unless anybody has anything else on this, I think we're ready to move on to our next topic, which is Wilson Contreras. I feel like this should be a running segment on the podcast, and that's, you know, insert a brand new young player called up from the farm system, explodes and has a great first 2 or 3 weeks debuting on the squad. But Wilson Contreras doing fantastic with the bat, looking great from behind the plate. Ryan, what are your thoughts on the job that Wilson Contreras has done so far?
It's mixed. I think at the plate he's been fantastic. I was just pulling this up just to see. You know, we all know that he got off to that really hot start. Even through the bad stretch recently, where they were, I think, 1-8 in the first 9 games to start July, he's still ripping the cover off the ball with a 9.33 OPS. So that's all very good. I have no complaints about him at the plate. I think he's been, probably better than we all expected, even at the plate. Behind the plate, I don't know. I see a lot of the issues with his receiving that people were talking about. I'm not as well in depth to be able to tell you what those are and how he can fix it. Isaac may be able to do that a little better than I can, but. Yeah, somebody pointed out to me on Twitter, it seems like anytime he calls for a fastball up, he gets up out of his crouch. And that just kind of seems like not the best thing to do. I don't know. It just seems like the things people talked about where he's very raw behind the plate still, that definitely seems like it's true.
I'm gonna jump in real quick because I was saving this stat, which was something surprising I found, because we've talked about him before in the past about, you know, his receiving, his framing specifically. His framing, even though it's very early, I think he's got like between 600 and 800, framing chances so far. It's positive. I mean, and he's been on the negative side of this his whole time that we've been able to measure this in the minor leagues. He's on 2.6. FRAA. So he's a positive framer so far in his major league career. So I thought that was interesting. But also that one specific example you gave, Ryan, about him standing up out of the crouch. I'm not a major league pitcher, but I have pitched and I still pitch. And when a catcher does that to me, you know, he makes it very clear. I do not want you to throw, a pitch that's high on the highish part of the zone. I want you to come way up here because this is where I want you to go. Because the idea isn't to just throw high strike. It's to get it up out of the strike zone. So I have no issue with that. Whether or not that's something major league, pitching coaches frown upon, I don't know. But I thought that was interesting. And the other thing I wanted to also touch on, I'm curious to hear your guys' opinion, is the fireness. Which is something I did not know about him. The way he's been playing and the way he's been, he's acting like he belongs there. If somebody has a problem, he stands up to Jeff Francoeur and says, "Hey, what's up? Let's go." It's a fire that is good to see from such a young guy. I don't know how other major league teams or players feel about a young guy standing up so quickly and taking kind of that role, but it seems to be that that's who he is.
I love it.
Yeah, well, a lot of thoughts here.
I
do too, and I think that I'm personally deriving a lot of joy out of seeing Wilson Contreras play the game, and I wish everybody played this way. He's running the bases like he thinks he's Javier Baez, which is amazing to see. He's flying out of the crouch and he's chucking balls.
Joy is a good word.
Yeah, he's chucking balls down the third base line, and I smile when he does those things because this is a guy that's going to hone his craft, and he hasn't been catching for very long, and he makes some mistakes that, you know, we might not have made in high school because we understood the position a little better already. But the fact of the matter is his athleticism is so above and beyond what we're used to seeing at the catcher position that I am thrilled to see these mistakes because that means that he's going to be that good coming, you know, in the future. And as far as the framing runs above average that he has, I think he's benefiting a lot from catching Kyle Hendricks. And Kyle Hendricks is gaining a reputation as being – the best strike thrower in the game, in my opinion, from a command standpoint. And I think he's benefiting from that. But to kind of touch on your question, Ryan, about where he stands up for it, I think what he's doing is something that he may have learned in the lower levels when he didn't know pitchers quite as well or they didn't have quite as good of command. My thing is it's totally unnecessary. When you're catching John Lester or John Lackey or Kyle Hendricks, you don't need to do that. If you have a good enough rapport with your pitcher and they understand, look, it's a 1-2 count and we're trying to throw a fastball up above the guy's letters at his chin, they know they need to throw that without him giving it away to the hitter and giving it away to himself and the umpire that they're trying to throw a high fastball. So I don't love giving it away that dramatically. And Carlos makes a good point. Yeah, it's fine. But I think in time he'll realize that his pitching staff is mature enough, they have good enough command in general, that he doesn't need to do that. They know what it needs to be without him doing that exaggerated move.
Yeah, I agree with what you just said there. And just in general, you do see the fact that it's unrefined, and that's not me making a commentary and saying, boy, this guy sucks behind the plate. That's not it at all. I think there's obvious skill, and you're right. I think it's very clear he's going to work hard to turn himself into an amazing catcher. But how many times have we seen a wild pitch or a pass ball go back to the backstop? I think there's been two or three times where a player leading off an inning struck out and got to first base in the last couple days. So
yeah,
I know it happened today. I feel like it happened yesterday too. So there's things that there's I would say if we were giving him a report card, what we've seen so far at bat, I'm giving him an A, and behind the plate, I'm giving him an incomplete.
Yeah, and it's I totally agree. You kind of have to grimace and take the good with the bad some. I think what's exciting is how great he can be back there in time. But right now, there's no question that he's a young bull and he needs some training.
Yeah, do you remember that when he got hit in the Denver Nuggets there on a foul tip and he went dancing yes. around the infield? That was one of the most hilarious things I've ever seen on Baseball Diamond.
That was fun.
Not afraid to express his pain.
He is irrepressible.
Irrepressible.
And, I mean, when you think about it, it's kind of the ideal scenario to bring a kid like him up with Montero on the roster. You know, David Ross is hurt now, but when he was on the roster, it's like you got two really good framers, veterans. David Ross, you know, much more veteran, but really a nice kind of space for him to come and occupy and get his major league career started. Whether or not he's going to be, you know, behind the plate when crunch time, you know, at the end of the season or in the playoffs, it probably not. But it's a good way for him to kind of wet his feet and get started and start his evolution as an everyday starter for this team in the future.
Well, that actually brings me to a question I just wanted to ask, and that is, do we get the feeling that, yeah, this is kind of his job at this point? I don't really see Miguel Montero coming back to a point where at any point this season he's catching 3 or 4 days out of every five. I mean, do we believe, yes or no, that this is Wilson Contreras' time and that he's catching 3 out of every 5 from this point forward and is going to be, you know, basically between, I mean, half his time has been in left field and half his time has been behind the plate. So, I mean, do we believe he's in the lineup every day from this point forward?
I guess my question is, why the heck wouldn't he be? I mean, the guy's played 22
games.
That's
what I think.
And he's got 1.3 WARP in 22 games. He's basically played 1/8 of one season, and he's collected 1.3 WARP, which is not far from what a guy like Miguel Montero is over the course of a season. So, I you know, what's interesting about Contreras is I didn't even think about the fact, and this is a total oversight on my part, I didn't even think about the fact that his bat was going to be so good. This is a guy I saw play live several times in the minors, but his bat is so good that Joe Maddon is running him out to positions he has never played because he has to have him hitting 4th or 5th in his lineup. So if you can stick him back there behind catcher and go ahead and get guys like Jorge Soler or Javier Baez in there when so healthy, then yeah, do it, because this is a guy that's a 5 or 6 win player today, and he just started. You've got to get him back there.
I'm so excited to see this team at full health with Contreras behind the plate. I mean, can you imagine that the lineup we saw earlier this year where we're, you know, it's a two of three, Chris Bryant, Dallaire, and Baez in the lineup, or maybe Tommy La Stella too, you're working those guys in, and instead of, you know, Montero slash Ross behind the plate, it's Contreras with Montero and Ross taking, you know, one of the 5 days. I mean, this is an insane lineup we're talking about when everybody's healthy.
Speak to me soft.
I was hoping Tim Fedorovich would be behind the plate in the
playoffs. I think his time is not over. I think,
but it's a good
coming back.
It's a really good question about Contreras.
Scott Service has glove, will travel.
is he your starting catcher game one of the playoffs?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Probably, yeah. I don't want to see Montero up there. I have the same feeling when Montero comes up to the plate, the same feeling that I had when Chris Coughlin was coming up the last couple of weeks. I was like, oh shit, this guy. So well, yeah, I'm all in on him.
You could take that question two ways. One is the symbolic, is he your game one starting catcher? And just as that phrase, yes, I think he's your number one catcher at this point. But the fact is that Montero catches Arrieta. And if Arrieta's your number one starter in the playoffs, and I don't see at this point why he wouldn't be.
Well, that's where I was going with
then
it.
Then you absolutely have Montero back there.
And your game two starter is going to be David Ross, right?
Yeah.
No, so I think Montero, actually, probably.
Contreras in left field. And then okay. Bryant at third, and yeah.
And
it's not an optimal defensive lineup.
I don't know. I'm not sure right now. Yeah, probably true. It's probably true, but there's a huge part of me that says that guy's bat is too special to keep out of the lineup at any point. I believe strongly in defense up the middle, but that his bat is special, and I'm not sure that you can bear to not have him in the lineup. He's also, to me, he's a little bit, I don't know, he's the type of guy that seems like he can hit absolutely anybody on any day, and having a guy that's a little bit ace-proof or whatever is strong, especially seeing what the Mets did to us last year. I like the way he works the counts, draws his walks, so putting him in there somewhere, I think you got to get in there.
And I was watching the game today, and he got down 0-2 real quick, and I was like, oh boy, let's see what this young guy does, and I forgot what exactly the pitch was, and I might have the sequence all wrong, but he got down in the count really quick, and then he took, I believe it was a fastball, it was something on the inner part of the plate, and he took it the other way. The right fielder made a nice running catch by the wall, but I thought that was, you know, that's one of the signs that I like to see on a young player is, you know, trying to stay back, even if you've got two strikes, and just kind of putting that ball in play. He took it the other way, he took it pretty far.
Yeah, he has an excellent approach. He's not afraid to go the other way at all. And one thing that didn't really show up in the minor leagues until this year, and right at the end of last year, is his power. But he's got a lot of power. He's got a lot more power than he's actually shown. And it's the difference between raw power and game power, which are actually graded as two different things in the scouting world. But his raw power has always been there. He is a big guy. He's got great bat speed. And when he learns how to elevate and put backspin on the ball, I really believe that he's going to hit a lot of home runs. And you're starting to see that. Obviously, he's already hit five. But combined with the approach that he has and the ability to hit power to all fields, he's a special hitter. He's a special hitter at catcher, which right now there's about two of those in the entire league. So it's an asset that is Theo Epstein is extremely happy to have.
Well, Wilson Contreras has the rest of the season to get out of Ryan Davis's incomplete doghouse. We'll see what he can do. Until then, let's move on to Baseball Prospectus came out with their midseason top 50, and the Cubs had three players place: Eloy Jimenez. Oh my God, I'm blanking on the shortstop.
Gleyber Torres,
man. We talked about him so much, and now I'm blank. And Ian Happ. So let's talk a little bit about these three guys, kind of the state of the – a quick glance at the state of the system that these three placing in that list, what that tells us about them, and a little bit more about the players. So, Isaac, you want to share your thoughts on this?
Yeah, and actually, to be honest, I haven't really put my thoughts into a really well-refined area yet, but I tweeted about 6 weeks ago when Eloy had a two-home run game, I tweeted that he would be shooting up the Cubs list and might threaten for number one. To be honest, I didn't actually think that by mid-season when some of these lists came out that he would overtake Gleyber Torres for number one, but the fact that BP put him at number one actually shows you what this kid is, Eloy Jimenez, what he is. And Eloy Jimenez came in at 28th on the BP Top 50, and he, to me, might be the guy with the very highest ceiling on that list, with apologies to maybe Yoan Moncada. He's a 19-year-old young man that has light tower power. He can absolutely crush the ball. The other thing that he has shown this year is a refinement at the plate and the ability to take walks. If anybody was watching the Futures game, he was playing right field, and he's not known for his defense. He has a great arm, but he's not known for his defense. He made a catch tonight, diving over the railing and flipping over into it, that made him look like a future above-average right fielder, which is saying something for a 19-year-old playing in the Futures game. He followed that up by hitting a monster home run. So you're talking about a guy that's 28th on the list, and if by the beginning of next year he's not in the top 6 or 7, I'll be surprised. I think he's a top 6 or 7 prospect in the major leagues, which is just ridiculous to say considering how many players the Cubs have already promoted. But Eloy Jimenez deserves as much or more of the praise that I just heaped on him, and that's not even getting into Gleyber Torres or Ian Happ, which I'll let Ryan and Joel talk about.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Joel.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, Jimenez, yeah, I mean, we've been hearing about him for a while, and he seems like everything I've read about him, and I haven't seen him that much. I did see the catch that he made tonight, and it was remarkable. And it's just exciting to see them, see the Cubs drafting a position player of that skill. Ian Happ, it's funny for me to see him make the top 50, even though I believe he was number 50. But, you know, when the Cubs drafted him, you know, you had your Schwarbers and your Bryants and your, Al Morris, although that was a couple years ago. But, you know, everyone was very excited. And I think people were a little more muted about him because they thought he was kind of a tweener, and a good bat and semi-decent glove. But it's interesting to see that, and it's very exciting for me to see that the Cubs are now, you know, able to take players and improve them, whereas that was not the case for so long. They would draft players and they would just disappear. So it seems to me that he's clearly improved, and I don't know, second baseman of the future. I don't know. What's your take on him, Ryan?
I've seen basically people say his ceiling is regular all-star, and just pulling up his stats real quick, this season between high A and double A, 316 average, 415 on base, 500 slugging with 9 home runs total. Those are really good numbers. I mean, this guy is, 76 strikeouts and 354 plate appearances, so, a little bit of a strikeout guy, but not terrible, I guess. And he's played mostly second base. I don't see any reason to believe that this guy couldn't be another one of your infielders of the future if you had a spot for him. Now, at the same time, do you have a spot for him? Yeah. I don't know. I think he could be one of those guys that is real tantalizing if you wanted to make a big deal, just not saying this is what I'm going for or what the Cubs might be doing, but if you wanted to make a package deal, let's say, with a team like Oakland that's selling a lot of pieces, where you get a starter, a reliever, and an outfielder all at the same time, or two relievers at the same time, Ian Happ might be one of those guys.
Yeah, and I'm always guilty of taking the long view, but I actually don't want to see the Cubs move any of these three guys. The interesting thing about Ian Happ is he has struck out 76 times in 294 at-bats, which is generally kind of alarming, but you have to turn the table on that and look at his walks. He has walked 53 times in 84 games, which is an absurd amount. You're talking about in a 100 walk pace for a middle infielder. So that tells me that it's not so much a swing and miss issue, but it's an approach for Ian Happ. It's more like Chris Bryant, where he's seeing deep count after deep count after deep count after deep count because he knows that he can get on base. He also knows he needs something to drive. So I think Ian Happ is a special hitter, and I admit I was late on the train. I was a little bit bearish about him. I wanted Andrew Benintendi in that draft so bad, but Happ is a really good bat. I think he could be a very, very special hitter. So in a lot of ways, I'd actually prefer, if they're going to move one of the three, that it would be Gleyber Torres, though I don't really want to, I don't really want to see that either. So I'd like to see them hang on to all three of those pieces, because I think that's how you're good for a decade rather than 4 or 5 years. I think if you hold on to those type of guys, that's how you really have a sustained decade of success, and that's what I'm here for. I'm here for 8 or 9 shots at a World Series, and hopefully 3 or 4 of them come to fruition.
Now, I mean, doing the math real quick, that's about a 21% K percentage. So it's not as bad as I think we're making it out to be, although a lot of that, you know, if you look at the fact that he's striking out 76 times and 294 at-bats because of all the walks, that's a little different when you're talking about just overall contact. But trips to the plate and Ks, it's only about 21%. So that's not so bad. And he's also only 21, and he's already made it to Double A, which I think is a huge point.
And
only seven strikeouts and 61 plate appearances at Double A. So, yeah, there's a lot of special going on here.
No question. And along with that, if this is a guy that's hitting singles every time up, that's one thing. But he's got 33 extra base hits. He's got 21 doubles and 3 triples. And that was actually the point I was going to make about Eloy as well, is Eloy Jimenez this year has give me a second to switch away. Eloy Jimenez has 40 extra base hits. He has 29 doubles, a triple, and 10 home runs. That's in 80 games. So that's about if you're talking about a full major league season, that's an 80 extra base hit pace, which is a huge number. So again, these are two guys that both draw a ton of walks. They get on base and they hit for a lot of power. So it's exciting to think about. This is a 19-year-old and a 21-year-old, and that's still the future for the Cubs.
I was just looking at some video here, and there's some video on Twitter about Eloy Jimenez taking batting practice. He reminds me of like Dave Winfield. He's that big, and he's smooth. There's nothing, you know, awkward or gangly, and he's just going to get bigger and round out more. I mean, it's incredibly exciting to see, you know, him in the Cubs' future. I will say that I'm really surprised. I know Happ was doing well. I didn't know that he was doing that well, but I'm just surprised to hear you guys say that you might consider trading Torres before him, because everything I've heard was that Torres was, you know, so smooth and had no flaws and just was so polished. And, you know, Happ seemed more of, well, we'll see. But now it sounds like there's a different perspective here.
That's what happens when you hit 400 at Double A, my friend.
Yeah, I think that's what happens when you draw 52 walks in 80 games. I mean, it's 53 walks. It's seeing that kind of approach at such a young age is really special. And I don't in any way mean to diminish Gleyber Torres. I think he's as close to a can't-miss prospect as you can get at 19. But Happ's just a guy I want to see in the organization, because I really love his approach.
One other thing I wanted to mention about this top 50 and the players that the Cubs placed on there is it's a reflection of the system. Obviously, there's going to be lower-level guys on here because everybody else is on the big league roster, but still no pitchers. And I feel like where the pitchers are is where Gleyber Torres and Eloy Jimenez were their first year in the system, just kind of getting their feet wet and learning the basics of you know, being in pro ball. And I feel like that's where, you know, the big names that we've talked about, the big name pitchers that we've talked about in the system before, that's kind of what they're going through. Just in going through the box scores day after day, you know, you see Dylan Cease and you see, I can't remember the other guy's name, but all those young guys, you're like, okay, I want to see what they're doing, and they're struggling, or at least the numbers, you know, they're not getting the numbers that they want. But I feel like there's a large amount of pitchers in the system, and even though they're at the lower levels, they're kind of in a place where they're just kind of getting started and not yet, you know, shooting up the rankings and you know, speculating about getting called up or being included in deals. So still waiting to get, you know, a big name pitcher that's producing and showing numbers and kind of pushing their way up the system. But yeah, I think it is what it is, and it will come eventually.
I've got a really good example for what you're talking about, and that is I was credentialed and went and covered the Peoria Chiefs this week, which is a Cardinals affiliate. It's their A-ball affiliate. And I was covering two pitchers, Junior Fernandez and Sandy Alcantara, and I saw Alcantara pitch. He's a tall, thin kid. I think he's only 20. He's very good for his age. He has a fastball that touched 100 for the first time on his 92nd pitch of the game. He has a two-seamer that sits 89 to 93 and a four-seam that sits 95 to 100. So at any given time, you could get a fastball anywhere from 89 to 100. Then he's got a changeup that goes about 84, 85 and a curveball that goes upper 70s, low 80s. And he was making batters look silly. He went 6 1/3, one hit, 10 strikeouts or 11 strikeouts, something like that. And that's a guy who, in a thin Cardinals system at this point that doesn't have a lot of stars, is their 10th ranked prospect. And so that just tells you a lot about the kind of, you know, the kind of players the Cubs are missing right now when you talk about pitching. They don't have a Sandy Alcantara in their system that can be completely overlooked because you have other pitchers of similar ilk. But 2-3 years from now could be in a starting rotation as a number three or number four starter. That is what, when you talk about that's what I picture is, man, they could really use, if they had a guy like Sandy Alcantara, he would be their top pitching prospect right now.
Yeah, and I'm fine with it. At the end of the day, there's nothing more underrated than a major league starting pitcher that runs out there and gives you six innings and does it effectively over a series of years, and there's nothing more overrated than a big-time pitching prospect. They are incredibly fickle. They are incredibly injury-prone, unfortunately. I hate that part of the game, but they are. And they are extremely hard to predict. And the Cubs recognized this 5 years ago, and they took this approach for a reason. Volume, volume, volume. And I think that touches on your point, Carlos, which is they will come. We just don't know who they're going to be. And there will be one, two, three pitchers that develop out of the Cubs system that jump up and surprise us and look great. But look at a guy like Hendricks, and nobody wanted Hendricks. He was the plain-looking girl at the dance. He was, but ultimately he was marriage material. And I just think that, you know, in the scouting world, they throw around 10-stop a lot, which is there's no such thing as a pitching prospect, and it's sort of a joke. But at the same time, look at the Mets season. And the Mets are doing okay, but they've got Noah Syndergaard, who is probably going on the DL. Matt Harvey just had season-ending surgery. Steven Matz has a bone spur. That's three-fifths of the rotation. Zach Wheeler just had Tommy John. The only member of their rotation that is healthy is Bartolo Colon, and he's 82 years old and 410 pounds. So I just think that you cannot predict pitching. There are so few pitchers. There's 8 or 10 pitchers a year that you can predict around Major League Baseball, and the rest are all jump-ups. So I still think that their approach of hitters over pitchers is always going to be more predictable at the end of the day. And, yes, we'll get a few good arms, but it's so much more random chance than hitters will be.
Yeah, I agree on that because my instinct is I want to see those numbers, you know, at the minor league level. I want to see somebody just striking out crazy amounts of pitchers and just dominating so that we can kind of pin our hopes on, okay, here comes somebody that can be one-fifth of that rotation. But this approach that they've taken so far is, all right, well, we'll get a guy like Hendricks who's more polished and closer to being major league ready. Hey, we're going to go and sign a big-time free agent like John Lester. We're going to take a chance on a player like Jake Arrieta, Jason Hamill, etc. We're going to pick up a guy like Adam Warren, who I know we wanted to talk a little bit about today, and you know, bring him on the team in exchange for Starlin Castro, put him in the bullpen. But the long-term thinking being, this is a guy that has proven himself against major league hitters to be an effective starter. So they acquired him. So there's a guy right there that is much closer to being one of those, being able to take over one of those five slots without having to kind of pray and hope that they won't get hurt and that they'll continue to evolve. And as they go up the ladder, up the ladder, up the ladder, that they'll still kind of keep their elbow together and their shoulder. Here's a guy that's pretty much ready to go. And if any one of those guys in that rotation got hurt or whatever, he's ready to step in. So if they can keep this approach up, it's much safer. It's much more efficient. And sure, we don't get to see these big numbers, these big strikeout ratios in the minor leagues. But at the end of the day, who cares, right?
I have a trivia question while we're talking about the BP midseason 50 and the fact that, you know, we saw Eloy Jimenez kind of breaking out in the futures game tonight. Did you guys realize that the money they used to sign Jimenez in international free agency was money that they traded for? Anyone on that?
A slot, you mean an international slot?
Yeah, that was acquired money.
No, I didn't know that.
Do you guys remember this trade? They traded Scott Feldman to the Orioles.
Yep.
And they got back international. Yeah, and also some other guys too.
Yeah. Yeah, but they gave up Steve Clevenger. So
I know. Still smart. I have a friend that complained about that at the time, and even in the middle of last year, he was marveling at how great Arrieta was, and he was like, "But I still hate that they had to give up Clevenger." And I was like,
"Oh my God.
Have you looked at Clevenger? What is your complaint here? Just admit you were wrong." But whatever.
Yeah.
Man, I think this is a bit of a detour, but if any of you have not seen Eloy Jimenez's home run tonight in the futures game. He hit it off Ryan Stanek, who is a legitimate prospect, relief prospect for the Rays. And Jimenez hit a 95-mile fastball and barely kept it fair down. This is a 95-mile-an-hour fastball. Hit it, barely kept it fair down the left field line and hit it off the third deck. I mean, he is so short to the ball. He's, what is he, 6'5"? But his swing is so short to the ball, and he just a simple little swing, foot up, down, hips open, explode. I mean, you have to go watch it. It's unbelievable.
Sweet.
What more can you say? Yeah, sorry for the rabbit trail, but my goodness, is it impressive.
So before we move off from the midseason top 50, I know I briefly touched on Adam Warren, and I know if anybody has any specific thoughts on, you know, his first start, you know, he gave up a leadoff home run, and then he was pretty clean the rest of the way. This was our first look at him as a starter on the Cubs. Anybody else have any thoughts? I mean, he looked pretty good. He looked like he could step in and be a positive force in the rotation if needed.
I think Kat wrote something really, really good about that, where basically she said, you know, he was pretty good, but she doesn't have a whole lot of optimism that he'll continue that. And that's kind of how I feel about it based on what we've seen in the past and how he really pitched in that game. It was against the Reds. So,
right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I kind of pumped the brakes on that.
Now, when you say
imagining that he's going to be...
When you say that you're basing it on what you've seen in the past... What we've seen in the past from him out of the pen, right?
No, I was talking about him in pretty decent numbers with the Yankees last year, but the walks were a little bit up and the strikeouts were a little bit down, so I don't know how much I believe in that without him. I'll rephrase and say this way. I think Adam Warren has a future as a starter, but Adam Warren, what he was last year, I don't believe is a long-term solution in the rotation. I think he has good stuff. The secondary pitches are excellent when he uses them properly and when he ditches his cut fastball just completely because it's a terrible pitch. So I think if he works with, you know, the Cubs pitching coaches and Chris Bosio and whoever they have down at AAA that's, you know, helped work with some of their pitchers, I think he can turn into a very good rotation option, but as of right now, I'm questioning whether he's had that amount of time working with those guys to be what we're hoping he can be.
I completely agree with that, and I agree on his cut fastball as well, and the problem with his cut fastballs is it doesn't cut. And
It's absolutely murdered.
It's insane
over the course of his career, the numbers. I think left-handers are slugging in his career like 600 off that pitch.
It just doesn't move. It's straight. It's flat. It's straight. It's on a flat plane. And the other problem is he can't locate it. So for me, if Adam Warren is going to be a starter long-term, he either needs to find a cutter that cuts, or he needs to learn how to locate his four-seam fastball a lot better than he does, because his curveball and changeup are there. He's fine with his secondary offerings, like Ryan has pointed out on a couple of different occasions in good pieces, but he needs to learn how to locate his fastball. And he can do that, And I think he can, knowing who he is as a person and seeing the simplicity of his mechanics and knowing that he's working with Bazio. And I think he can do it, but as he is right now, he only gets away with it because he has good secondary stuff. And the moment that he throws a fastball at the wrong time, it gets hammered. So he either needs a cutter that cuts or he needs to learn how to locate his four-seamer with a lot more regularity.
Fair enough. That's a good point about what he's done in the past as a starter and what we've seen, even though it's just been the one start. So before we get to our regularly scheduled segments, let's talk a little bit about the injuries. The Cubs have been hit by a fair amount of injuries this season. They've had the roster to kind of backfill those injuries, has been my impression. I mean, they've gotten, you know, good stuff out of Almora, good stuff out of Contreras. This is a team that has been built for this type of situation. Ryan, what do you think about the injuries that the team has had and how they've been able to deal with them?
Well, I think it's been pretty positive overall how they've dealt with them. Yeah, they've called up Contreras and Almora and Jaimer Candelario, and they've called up some kids in the bullpen. Overall, I think the way they've handled it has been great, and the depth that they have in the organization has really helped. But, and I think I'm going to elicit a response from Joel on this when I say, a big part of the overall slide that they've been in, even before it got real bad recently where the pitching was basically giving up a 9 ERA, before that, when they were just kind of treading water, a lot of that had to do with the injuries. And I think, you know, I don't remember what the stat was or what it would be now, but the record with and without Dexter Fowler is really eye-opening. Since he went on the DL is when a lot of this has started, where originally it was just kind of treading along, like, okay, so they're not blowing everybody out anymore, and they're, you know, okay, so maybe we'll win 2 out of 4, or, you know, whatever it is. But I think the major point is, when this team is fully healthy, then they're really flying, but without a lot of those players, it's just been too difficult for them to get along right now, and I think you're seeing that with the, you know, the overall 500 record in the last nearly 60 games.
Yeah, I mean, Ryan and I had a polite discussion on this on Slack today or yesterday. And my feeling is that, I mean, obviously the injuries are bad, but Fowler clearly, I just had no, it's funny because we were preparing to go this year without him. And when they signed him, I was like, oh, you know, that's really nice. That's great. But I didn't realize how integral he was to their offense. And, I mean, the offense has still looked pretty decent through this run, but I can't put too much of the onus on their slide on injuries because, you lost Fowler. That's bad. But then you lose Soler. Well, that just means you put Bryant in left or Contreras in left, and Baez is playing more, and he's obviously demonstrating that he deserves to stay up here. So it's not like you're seeing, you know, uh-oh, Soler's injured. Now we're seeing, Chris Coughlin. And I don't see – you know, Tommy La Stella, to me, is just kind of a wash. He hasn't played that much and hasn't made that much of an impression since he's been back. To me, the glaring issue has been the starting pitching. And as we talked about earlier, starting pitching was due for regression, but it hasn't been a regression. It's been, you know, fallen off the cliff. And I think that, you know, you've just seen a ridiculous amount of homers lately. And I think it's just, you know, it's just the roller coaster ride, and everyone's kind of hit the wall at the same time. And hopefully, the All-Star break gives everyone a chance to kind of clear their head, and especially Lester and Arrieta. And if they do that, and then we can get Fowler back, I think that you're going to see, you know, this team peel off a 8 or 9 game winning streak, and the bandwagon, which was getting a little thinner, is going to get full once again.
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy to look at the depth of this Cubs team and say, well, we can do this, and if that guy goes out, then this guy can slide in, and that's nice, and it is a wonderful luxury to have. But at the same time, every one of those moves has a trickle-down effect, and the biggest trickle-down effect that I see from those moves is defensive deficiencies. And when you take Fowler out of that lineup, you can no longer have a great defensive outfield in many ways because you're generally putting Contreras out there, or somebody else that isn't as quality, Soler, if he's healthy. So I think there's been a real trickle-down effect there defensively, and it has really shortened the Cubs' bench as well, as to where there's guys getting at bats at times late in games that you're like, oh, you mentioned it about Montero. I don't want to see him hitting here. I don't want to see Coughlin hitting here or Fedorovich or whoever it's been during this period of time. But I think that Fowler's absence has shortened the Cubs' lineup pretty seriously. It moves Bryant and Rizzo to the 2 and 3 spots, which, of course, they're great, but it really changes that top of the order, and I think that has hurt even the psyche of the club. I think it's also hurt from the standpoint of Fowler sees a ton of pitches, so it's helped the opposing pitcher not wear out so much early in games. So it's all these little trickle-down effects that I think has had a pretty big impact. And there's no doubt that when Joe Maddon says, Dexter, you go, we go, that didn't come out of nowhere. Joe Maddon knows that Dexter Fowler sets the tone for this team, and they're missing that. So I do think it's important. I'm not going to attribute the losing to it, but I think it's important. I think it was a one or two game swing during this period for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see that point, and I get that it threw everything off. And, you know, even Tommy La Stella, you know, he's no one's idea of a, you know, all-star, but he did have his place, and because he's not there, then it just kind of unsettles everything. But, you know, keep in mind, though, defensively, you're replacing Fowler with Almora, and you could make a pretty strong argument that that's a step up in center, and left, maybe, it's just, I mean, then you're losing Soler. So I don't know about defensively, but I do see your point for sure about how it just kind of unsettles everything. And Soler, I mean, I don't know. I just don't see him here next year. I think Schwarber's your left fielder next year. But I can see the point about how everything just kind of gets a little shaky with these other players out.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say before we move on to 60 Seconds of the Former Cub is this is the time when fans need to remember, you know, before the season begins and they're building out their optimal roster and they're saying, oh, we should trade this person, we should trade that person. Here's our left fielder, and this is the person that we need to have, and that's all we need because that's the person we want out there 162 games. That's not the way it works. You have to have
great
that depth.
Point.
Yeah, you do not want to get rid of Javi Baez. Look at what he's done in filling all these different positions. I mean, and the fact that Fowler is on the team, and it was kind of a surprise, but like Joel mentioned, without him, oh my gosh, what would have happened? So you need to have all this depth. You can't just have your eight starting guys out there in the field and expect them to go. And innately, we kind of know that, but this is when you really feel and understand that situation. So anyway, was there something
No, I think that's just a great point, Carlos. And so often people want to build
Isaac.
Yeah, they want to build out their optimal lineup, and it's easy then to say, well, it's not eight hitters, it's 12 or 13, and then, well, it's not 12 or 13, but it's a 25-man roster. Mm-hmm. Here's the reality: it's a 40-man roster, and any one of those guys can be needed at any point in time. And the more people look at building out their roster at 40 men rather than 25, the more successful you're going to be able to do into taking a holistic view of the team. And that's, I think, what this Cubs team is embodying is this is a 40-man roster, and every guy is important. And I think that's the way fans need to look at it far more than just saying, that's our left fielder and it's Kyle Schwarber, because 8 at-bats into the season and he's out for the year. So I think it's great that you brought that up.
One last quick blurb that I want to throw out there on this is it is important because it's a 40-man roster. Look at it this way. The Cubs had stayed healthy all year. Maybe we don't see Almora or Candelario or a few of these other names that have been talked about or called up until September. And the rookie struggles and that initial learning in the season, aren't you glad that they're doing that in July rather than in September?
Yeah, yep, for sure. Great point.
All right, we're going to move on to 60 Seconds with a Former Cub. Joel, you got Todd McPenis tonight, or who's up?
He's next week. Way to scoot me, Carlos.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, you know, I try to do guys who maybe fly a little under the radar. I mean, you know, you have your perpetual all-stars like your George Mitterwald. But I...
Are you talking about Todd Dunwoody, by the way?
No, Todd McPenis.
Yeah, Todd Dunwoody.
They're cousins.
Oh, okay.
Second cousins. But so I was looking today, and I saw that today is the birthday of a one Andre Dawson. Andre the Hawk Dawson, so I figured that we had to go with him. So today's 60 Seconds is Andre Dawson.
Ready, go.
The story of how Andre Dawson joins the Cubs is legendary. He wanted to play for the team, but the Cubs management said, nah, we're good with Brian Dayette. So Dawson signed for $500,000, which made him the second lowest paid player on the team. Dawson went on to put one of the great seasons in pre-steroid Major League history. He hit 49 homers, 137 RBIs, and slugged .896, and was the first player to win MVP for a last-place team. The highlights of that year include the time he drove in 7 runs, or he hit 3 homers in a game, or the time he threw out a runner at first base from right field. Oh, and he hit for the cycle in that game, too. And then there was the time he hit the ball out of the park in his last at-bat of the season at Wrigley. It was truly a year for the ages, and that's how I'll remember him, not hitting 105 with 6 strikeouts and 19 at-bats in 1989 playoffs. Maybe that's why he wore a Montreal Expos hat in a Cooperstown rather than a Cubs hat, but hey, we'll let him have that.
Hawk.
He was amazing. I mean, that guy.
And also, you know, he got lost in the ivy. I don't know if you guys know that, but he got stuck in the ivy for like several years.
Yeah, that was really unfortunate.
Video evidence.
Yes.
He went on to play after, you know, in 89, he looked like he was done. He played until 96. And granted, that year he only had, 61 plate appearances. But still, that amazes me. He played another 7 years.
Didn't he go to the Marlins?
He went from the Cubs to the Red Sox and then to the Marlins.
Yeah, Red Sox first. And then he worked for the Marlins for a really long time.
Yeah, yeah. He had that whip of a swing, you know. It was so amazing. Did you ever see him throw out the guy at first? I think it was a pitcher, but it was a pretty solid single to right, and then just wound up and threw the guy out. And it's like, wow, I'd never seen that before.
I've only seen that a handful of times, and I think I know the player you're talking about. And I vividly can remember seeing it. I think, but. The only other time I can remember seeing it is rest in peace Daryl Kyle with the Cardinals.
Really?
I feel like I think I saw Vladimir Guerrero throw him out of first base.
There's an arm.
Yeah, that's my young fandom. I believe that's the first time I had ever seen it, so it stuck with me.
Mm-hmm. All right, from Andre Dawson to our listening public. Did we get a question this week, Ryan, for question of the week?
Yeah, this one is pretty good. It's from Brad Horth on Twitter. Let me know if I pronounced that wrong. But he asks, how responsible for the slide has sequencing, home run and to fly ball rate, and good old bad luck been?
Not nearly as responsible as not being able to throw the ball across the plate, which is both Arrieta and Lester's problem right now. It's just simply not throwing strikes. So I
Lackey, too.
Lackey too. Yeah, there's no excuse and no replacement for simply challenging the hitter and throwing strikes. So sequencing is some of it when you see these home runs, but you cannot be not throwing strikes. The problem is when you're wild like that, it also means that often your strikes are not good strikes and right in the middle of the plate. And that's what you're seeing. You're seeing a combination of walks, far too many walks, and far too many meatballs. And that's as basic as I can boil it down, but that's what I'm seeing.
My point on that would be when you play 24 consecutive games without any rest for the bullpen and you're not, I mean, the one start from Warren bumped everybody back a start, but I think you're seeing a lot of very tired arms right now, and that is probably the biggest culprit, which has been kind of the domino effect we talked about with injuries. The tired arms can't throw the same quality of strikes, and then when they're trying to get the get me over fastball and it's getting pumped out by Andrew McCutchen in 450 feet, I think that's where a lot of this is coming from. So I know people like to look at home run to fly ball rate and say, well, that's got to change because that's just happening too much. That over the course of a season, we're talking about a single player. Yeah, I agree, but I think here the biggest culprit is tired arms.
So let me ask you this then. Did they throw too many innings at the beginning of the season?
I don't know. Because I tend to look at pitches thrown rather than innings thrown.
That's more what I meant. Did they throw too many pitches early in the season?
I saw that Sahadev Sharma made a point to a fan that I was tagged in the tweet last night where he said, through the first couple months of the season, the Cubs were right in the middle of the pack for pitches thrown by starters.
Part of that's, though, because of... part of that's because they were so effective, I think, that they had it. I guess my question would come down to, given the nature of the construction of their team, did they throw too many pitches? And, of course, this is a... a trap question, but it just makes you wonder, because then you run into this stretch in the in the middle of the summer, you have 24 games in 24 days, and it goes, oh, this is why they don't throw 8 innings in April. It does make you wonder about those early days.
Yeah, I can see it that way, and I did bring up in that Twitter conversation, maybe it was middle of the road, but they also had constructed their roster so that they wouldn't be, overusing their starters or making them throw too many pitches, but then they didn't really use it that way. I don't know. I don't know if you can complain about that so much, really, considering there is no clear point where you can say, okay, they abused somebody here, or they overused them.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And part of what was tough about that is they were so dominant. The starting five was so historically dominant that it was like, well, if they're going to be this good, then why does it matter how we constructed our team? And that I fully understand that point. It does. I fully also agree, though, that you're seeing tired arms, and I think that's a lot of it, because there is a lot of get me over pitches that are just that, and they're getting hammered.
Yeah, and I think that hopefully the All-Star break, letting them rest their arms and coming in, hopefully with Dexter Fowler back, that means that they'll be playing better baseball starting off the second half. But unfortunately, first six are 3 with Texas, 3 with the Mets. So the freaking out fans may continue if the Cubs drop 2 of 3 to Texas and then 2 of 3 to New York again. So.
Well, moving from the pitching over to the hitting side of things, what do we have for the at-bat of the week, Isaac?
The at-bat of the week actually came today, and there was two different ones that I considered, because I really felt like when the Cubs blew the early 2-0 lead, they were down 3-2, then got it back to 3-3, I felt like the fourth inning home run by Albert Almora was just a huge turning point in that game, and what felt like a very, very important game for the Central Division, though. I considered giving it to Albert Almora, but I did it on his first home run as well. So instead, what I'm going to take is the 5-5 tie in the top of the eighth inning when MVP candidate Chris Bryant came up with Matt Caesar on second, perennially underrated Matt Caesar, who had just hit a double, which was also a very huge hit. Chris Bryant came up with 2 outs and faced Tony Watson, who is a very effective left-handed reliever and has been for years with the Pirates. He swung and missed at an excellent changeup down in the zone. He then took a 95-mile-an-hour sinker for a ball. And then the Pirates catcher sat up on the inside corner and down below Bryant's knees, probably by about 3 or 4 inches. And Watson hit the target east-west, latitudinally, for lack of a better term, but he missed his spot north-south by about 4 inches, and it came just above Bryant's knees into his lower thigh area, and he got around on a 94-mile-an-hour thing and whipped it into left field for a single. And Caesar came flying around third and scored just ahead of the throw from left field to give the Cubs a 6-5 lead, which would be the eventual game winner. So today's at-bat of the week is Chris Bryant singling home Matt Caesar for the game winner in the eighth inning for a game in July that felt a little bit more like a game in October.
It was a big at-bat by the VP candidate.
It was. And it's actually hard to overstate how good Bryant and Rizzo have been even during this bad stretch. It's gotten overlooked because the team's playing such losing baseball. But both of those guys have thrust themselves not only into the MVP conversation, but to me is the hands-down NL MVP at the halfway mark.
Any of you guys see who was out on the mound just a few minutes ago in the Futures game?
No, I didn't. Who was it?
Mark Pryor as a coach.
My God. I thought you meant as a pitcher. I was like, what?
Nope. Went out to the mound to talk to whoever it was. I'm just seeing a screenshot of it. Mark Pryor out there talking to the pitcher and the catcher.
Wow.
Did he have Pryor was pitching the old news game.
Yeah.
Yeah, he walked out there and gave him some advice, and then his arm fell off, and he carried it off the field.
Wow. on that note.
Well, we're at the break. We made it through a full half season of podcasting. So let's regroup and power through the second half, guys.
Can I say, let's try and make sure that all four of us are here when we record, because I so thoroughly enjoy the four of us on a podcast together. I think it's just so much better when it's just a few than when it's just a few of us.
That's certainly a lot of fun.
I hate to admit it, but I agree.
I miss you guys too.
Good night, John.
We should turn off the recording now.
With that. All right. Have a good one, Nick.
All right.
Night, guys.
See ya.